This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, we discuss Chicago's Outcome Health's ongoing issues. The show was recorded on December 8th. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
All right, Graham, one second.
Seems like if I was the manufacturer of these kind of microphones we use, seems like I might make the gain like just like dramatically less than it is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know anything about the way microphones are made. I know a decent amount about running live event sound, but man, seems like, I can see from your microphone on our video that that you and I both have our gain set at the lowest setting possible, which seems to mean that that knob is useless. So it seems like if there were a range that were much, much lower than the gain that's available to us, but that were dialable, life could be good. Oh, Jason, you look... Jason's dressing up like a ghost now for Halloween.
Idea.
Yeah, I don't know what you're thinking with that one.
Wait,
but,
okay, Graham.
But you're going to get really hot in there too.
I know. Does this help with any of the echo?
Yeah, I don't have any echo now. Plus, I get to laugh at you the whole time we record today.
I'm that's hot as hell. I'm already getting hot. Okay, this is a regrettable decision. All right. Okay, friends. So here's the situation. So if you've heard like some fabric against the microphone sounding kind of like this, you know, the sort of sounds that you definitely expect to hear while listening to a podcast. It's because, let me put on journalist hat for a second. Dateline, Rock Ridge, Oakland. Your long-suffering co-host and regular correspondent, Jason Rowley, am sitting in a downstairs apartment that's an Airbnb, and there are no soft surfaces in this room. So if I end up sounding a little echoey, you're going to have to forgive me, everybody. And I wanted, so the I made an attempt to create soft surfaces by taking the bed sheet off of the bed and sort of putting up a tent around me and the microphone and my computer. But that clearly was a bad idea. Graham, how are you doing?
But Jason, this is our new podcast on how to make sound effects during podcasts, right?
Oh, well, yeah, this is the Welcome to Foley Corner. Oh. What else can we do? We can make like horse sounds, like. Nope. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right. And everybody's going to get to listen to the extremely squeaky and crackly wicker chair that I'm recording from, and my Airbnb co-hosts, co-hosts, whatever the term is, the couple that from whom, you know, I'm renting this place, they're upstairs and they might be walking around. So this is going to be a show full of of sound effects and all the rest. So thank you so much for being here and being a little patient with everything that's about to transpire. So Graham, how are you? You are not in Oakland.
Well.
You're in Chicago. How's the last couple of days treated you?
I'm at home. Good, good. It's been a good week. It's been a busy week. I'm actually preparing for a trip to California. I will be coming out to California to the San Diego area tomorrow.
Mm.
But it's been a good week. Full of a lot of excitement, a lot of good things going on here.
Ever been out to San Diego?
I've never been to San Diego, so it'll be after the fact, obviously. But if anyone in our massive listening audience has any recommendations in San Diego, I'd love to hear them for my next trip. But no, this will be my first visit to San Diego ever, and my first visit to California as an adult. So
wow.
I'm actually super excited for tomorrow, notwithstanding that I need to do laundry, pack, you know, all of those normal, really boring adult things that are requisite to go on a trip.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. After our shrimp boil, that was my order of business too, was laundry, putting everything away, packing. It's never fun. But
no. Yeah, no.
You know, but Graham, you know what will be fun after we introduce ourselves is the topic that we are going to be discussing today, because it's one that's very let's just say near and dear to both of us, which is the ever evolving saga of a Chicago company called Outcome Health, formerly known as Context Media. But before we get into that, we should probably tell everybody a little bit about who we are. I can go
first.
Yeah,
I think that's a great idea.
All right. Hey, everybody. My name is Jason Rowley. I'm one of your co-hosts. I am a venture capital data journalist for Crunchbase News. And when I'm not doing that, I, on a volunteer basis, help to run startup outreach for the Python Software Foundation alongside some collaborators. We find cool companies doing cool things with Python and give them free booth space at PyCon US, which this year is taking place in late May in wonderful Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And you can find out more at us.pycon.org. And you can search for Startup Row if you're interested in applying. That's me. Graham, who are you?
My name is Graham Peck. I am a venture partner at Cultivation Capital. We are a Midwest-based seed and Series A stage fund that invests in life sciences, ag tech, and specifically the area I work on is software and IT technologies. Very excited to have great stuff going on there. Got awesome slate of companies we're working with and helping grow. And in addition to that, I also work with a couple of different Eastern European software development companies, primarily one named Brightgrove. What we do is help large and small technology companies build their tech teams using Eastern European talent.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, Graham,
I get bored easily. So,
do you?
As you well know, Jason. Yeah.
Mm. I get kind of bored pretty easily too. But anyways, you know what's not? This is not going to be a boring show because
I don't think so. not this week, anyway.
Yeah, because you know, Context Media / Outcome Health really is the gift that keeps on giving. From a, think of it as like it's like WeWork or Theranos or. You know, any one of these organizations that that over the last couple of years, you know, there's been like, oh, big scandal, you know, oh, allegation of fraud. And then it's just sort of like, hold my beer. let's try to one up the last, you know, the last story of at least alleged malfeasance and stuff. But Graham, before we get into that, I do feel obligated to give a slight disclaimer on our behalf, which is that, so listeners, I'm going to break the fourth wall for a second. One thing to keep in mind is that neither Graham or I, neither Graham nor I are lawyers, and we do not play them on the internet. We've not personally reviewed the evidence which led the Department of Justice to make its decision to file charges against Outcome Health's executives and certain senior employees. And the following discussion is based on our reading and personal interpretation of news reports, press releases, and other publicly available documents. We are not operating on any sort of super duper inside information here. We're just two folks talking about some news on the internet. So.
And in our wonderful show notes, we'll even tell you what, for the most part, what sources we used to.
Yeah. And it was really fun doing a little bit of research for this because, boy, did we find some resources. So,
you know, I guess one thing for me, you know, to kick off and get started is yeah. I'm personally really disappointed. And I think this is something you and I have talked about maybe a little bit on some of our public podcasts and a lot in our pre-recorded stuff that we used to get prepared to do this.
Yeah.
I'm personally really disappointed because as you and I are both based in Chicago, even though you're in California now and I'll be there in just over 24 hours, as a Midwestern guy, I really want to see the Midwest create great startups. You've written articles that we can link to about why you create more value if you're a Midwestern startup.
Yep.
And every time there is a Midwest or Chicago specifically as what I basically consider my hometown, certainly the town I live in now and love, you know, every time a company does what Outcome has allegedly done in this case, it really makes me sad. You know, because I think Chicago and I think the Midwest can do a great job building a venture ecosystem. It might be different than Silicon Valley. It might be different than New York or Boston.
As it should be.
I think, as it probably should be. I think Chicago deserves to be included among that. And every time something like this happens, and unfortunately, I feel like Chicago has a record or history of doing things maybe not identical to this, thank goodness, but where there are similarly bad people outcomes, not just a bad business outcome. It just makes me sad to be a participant in this community. And normally I want to be somebody who's excited to stand on a mountaintop and shout how awesome it is to be a Midwestern startup or Midwestern investor. And that's not true when I learn about what happens with Outcome and others.
Yeah. The good news is that, at least in this case, the alleged wrongdoing is so blatant that it sort of transcends into humor. But I think we should first and foremost give our give folks a little bit of a background on what Outcome Health it was in, or is in the business of doing, and sort of a very brief history of what has transpired over the recent, you know, over recent months and years. So
yeah. So I'll dive into the business if that's all right.
Yeah.
And then maybe you can cover the next step.
Hang on, Grant, before you go, I will have color commentary every once in a while when you describe the business. Okay. There we go.
So Outcome Health is a Chicago-based company originally founded by Rishi Shaw and Shraddha Agarwal. And I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing those names, but they met as students at Northwestern. And so it was touted, I think, as one of the kind of success stories of Northwestern's garage and startup ecosystem. They may have predated the garage, but they were touted as phenomenal, you know, participants in the Northwestern startup ecosystem. What they do specifically is in waiting rooms as well as treatment rooms of doctors' offices, they'll install tablets or TVs, other video screens, and they'll sell advertising to drug or other kind of pharmaceutical companies that provide other types of necessary treatment when you have some sort of malady, and they'll advertise directly to the patients or potential patients that are in those waiting rooms as well as specifically treatment rooms. I don't know how specifically they're tailoring what some of those ads are, but because of being so near to the point of care or point of potential care, they were getting really high advertising dollars from the pharmaceutical companies for being placed in those locations. So that's, I guess, my take on a little bit of the background of the company. Again, formerly Context Media, more recently rebranded to Outcome Health. And they have gotten themselves into a little bit of hot water.
Yep.
more recently, where there is some alleged fraud and malfeasance. And I think that stuff, the alleged fraud and malfeasance, maybe started to become apparent in late 2017/early 2018. Is that about right, Jason?
That, based on my understanding, that is when things started to become more publicly known, and that coincided with, and the reason why it became publicly known is because up until that point, the company was primarily funded, it was bootstrapped initially. It's my understanding, I might be incorrect, that Shah and Agarwal have some, you know, not inconsequential, you know, family resources that they were, you know, able to draw from initially. Then the company started making money. You know, it's the sort of stuff that it's the, they got their start. It started as the sort of like Chicago model success story, right? Like, you know, there's the stereotype of Chicago based startups and Midwestern based startups in general, because there isn't as expansive a venture capital base in the Midwest, that the companies will start up and, you know, immediately need to be cash flow positive, you know, relatively quickly. And that seems to be, again, without any access or really deep understanding of the company's financial records at all, it's my understanding that that was the case. I know that they had raised a fair amount of money in debt prior to May of 2017. But what really put the company on the map was a nearly $500 million. It was like $480-something-odd million. A big investment round. It was their first sort of outside equity investment. And that was a deal that was led by Goldman Sachs, but it also saw participation from Capital G, which is Google's growth equity investment arm, as well as a number of other investors, including Pritzker Group Venture Capital. And there was one other one that, hang on one moment. And then Prudence Holdings.
If only there were some sort of internet database where one could go and find information like this.
See, Graham, I'm sitting, not to besmirch my lovely Airbnb co-hosts, but their internet is leaves a lot to be desired at this time.
So for the moment, apparently mine at my home, my internet leaves something to be desired as well. I've run two speed tests since we started recording, the better of those two speed tests showed me that I'm getting 3.25 down and 7.5 up.
Holy crap.
I'm not sure what's going on with that, but that's pretty bad.
We got bad.
That's not what I pay for. I'm going to be calling Comcast as soon as this call is done. Anyway.
All right.
So back to more salient points.
Back to
that
other
are
stuff.
Not about nerdy internet speeds.
Sure. So, but like in addition to these, and these were just the four four firms that were sort of most publicly disclosed in the round. You know, there was we'll get into it later. There was a lawsuit filed against the company that also revealed that revealed a number of other counterparties to the deal, including. Among other things, the Emerson Collective, which if for those who are unfamiliar, that is the investment fund led by the late Steve Jobs' partner, Lorraine Powell Jobs. I think NEA was also a named complainant. What? I'm not a lawyer. Plaintiff, that's the word.
Complainants and plaintiff sound quite different, I think.
Well, but are they analogous? Like lexicon?
Well, I think it can be. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Sorry, we're gonna move away from Jason and Graham discuss grammar. Where was I? But when this company when Outcome raised close to $500 million in May of 2017. That is the first time that, at least with any degree of publicity, that a valuation was placed on the company, and its post-money valuation was north of $5 billion, which at the time made it, it being Outcome Health, one of the most valuable privately held companies in Chicago and indeed the Midwest. And because Rishi... Shah controls, or controlled at least, 80% of the or owned 80% of the company. It made him an instant billionaire, at least on paper. And similarly for Shraddha, you know, massively increased her net worth as well. So that's when things sort of, a lot more scrutiny probably was being put on onto the company. So to answer your question, it was sort of like around 2017 when things, when people started asking more pointed questions about the company's business model and its track record to date.
You know, as someone who, and we haven't talked about this a lot in our podcast, I'm glad to, glad to go into greater detail if that would be necessary for any of our, you know, really astute listeners. But, you know, I've looked at doing a lot of acquisitions and other things. I've looked at using debt financing as one of the vehicles.
Yep.
One of my questions before getting into any of the specifics that are covered in the complaint or any of the other articles I've read that kind of cover it, you know, before they raised any of that equity from these big name, VCs who tons of questions for them and their due diligence process, because those are the types of things that I sit in on nearly every day in my role at Cultivation. We write much smaller checks and invest at an earlier stage. So tons of questions for those guys. But they had also raised something like $475 or $485 million in debt financing in a couple of separate debt rounds. So I would also have a bunch of questions from, and I haven't seen any specific participation in the complaints or other things that I reviewed from any of their debt lenders, but it would be my gut instinct that some of this malfeasance probably had to have predated or substantially predated even the debt rounds that they raised, which I think the specific complaint indicates, the first debt round was raised as early as April 2016. So, you know, as much as I'm a big believer in Midwestern startups and don't want to, complain about any of them, it seems like the thing that I think is really negative here is like that some of this stuff might have been long and far reaching fraud.
Yeah, indeed. That is indeed what it seems like. So let's get into some of the, Graham, there are so many different things that happened with Outcome to disentangle. And for the record, dear listener, we're going to do a very bad job of explaining everything because we're not going to keep you here for many, many hours. And in fact, one could probably launch, and this is not for me to do, and Graham, I doubt you'd be into this either, but there might be an opportunity for somebody in the future to launch their own podcast specifically going through line by line or day by day all of the shenanigans that happened at Outcome Health based solely on publicly available information in the press and in legal disclosures following lawsuits against the company. But if you'll allow me, I think there's a couple of really key points to make. So one, as we previously mentioned, the company was in the business of installing screens in doctors' offices to, you know, that displayed sort of in-house created video content, other sorts of informational material, nominally aimed at sort of educating patients about, you know, the general practices of like good health and all that good stuff, right? Interspersed throughout this, you know, nominally educational content were ads for pharmaceutical stuff. Which, just for the record, I think is kind of a gross business. I was going to put this in my personal newsletter, but I decided to take it out because I thought it was a little inflammatory for that audience, but you get it this time, friends. It's that to me, it's sort of analogous to like advertising funeral homes and like crematoria, like on large televisions at the city morgue. It's like you have this captive audience who has no, who probably doesn't really want to be there. And you're just pelting them with like ads for, you know, stuff that they might not necessarily be in the best position to make decisions about. But my own personal beliefs about, you know, the healthcare system, you know, I'll put those aside. But so anyway, so they were in the business of basically generating ad impressions for pharmaceuticals and medical devices and all the rest. And to make a long story, you know, relatively short, a lawsuit alleged that the company had created had misrepresented the number of ad impressions that it was generating because it was at least, and again, as alleged in a lawsuit, that Outcome Health was selling ad inventory that it simply didn't have, right? It was saying, I'm going to make up a number, you know, I'm wholly hypothetical numbers for the sake of illustration. You know, the company may have said, okay, we have, 300 screens displaying ads for pick your pharmaceutical, you know, when we want to sell a block of ads for those 300 screens. Well, in actuality, they may have only had, you know, 200 screens or 250 screens or whatever. I don't know the full extent of that misrepresentation, but it was misrepresentation nonetheless and sufficiently material to prompt a long series of investigations by, among other things, like the Department of Justice, totally ignoring the fact that these folks had the temerity to like attempt to defraud Google, which is like the consensus leader on like ad impression tracking, on like ad impressions. Like that's some serious chutzpah right there. So, you know, entrepreneurship is sometimes a full contact sport. I really appreciate and applaud Rishi and Shraddha's hashtag bravery in going up against Big Goog with their again shenanigans at the company. But this Graham is not a thing that we have to use. This part is not something that we have to use the word alleged around, because Outcome Health agreed to pay out, and this was a press release from October 30th, 2019, from the U.S. Department of Justice. Outcome Health agreed to pay out $70 million to resolve a fraud investigation. You don't settle a lawsuit if you're innocent.
You know, and I think one of the things that's interesting and that seemed to come about around that time is that there were people inside the company who had reported that they were doctoring screenshots. Because what I think I had heard or seen, and I'll actually dig up and see if we can find what I had read around that time. But around that time, there were articles which seemed to indicate that I think unnamed sources said that there were, that they spent time doctoring screenshots because the company knew that there were some overstatement in the number of screens that they had live in doctor's offices. And I think exactly what you're talking about, you know, let's pretend it was 300 screens they claimed they had live and 200 actually were. They had an internal system which went back and audited that each of those impressions was actually legitimate. And I think there were employees who, again, I believe unnamed employees, but employees who came out and said, oh yeah, I was doctoring screenshots for our auditing system by editing IP addresses, timestamps, and other things like that to show that this impression, quote unquote, was real when it wasn't. I guess one of the bigger things, and not maybe to kind of jump around within the topic here,
yeah,
but to jump around a little bit, as a venture investor, I get that like not every business is going to not every business is going to have a good outcome, right? We're using portfolio theory. We're investing in a bunch of companies. Some are going to have positive outcomes. Some are going to have negative outcomes. Some are going to turn from negative to positive, and unfortunately, actually vice versa too. But, you know, one of the things like, and one of the articles that I read that I think actually you sent me the link to, Jason, so I think you've read as well. One of the articles that I read as I prepared for this topic was, there's a really big difference between fraud and a bad business outcome.
Yeah.
And I'm not happy about a bad business outcome ever. But I think there's something I can do about that, or my team and I am just one part-time member of a very phenomenal 11-person team. And kudos and a big shout out to my team here. You know, I think, not to break my arm, patting our collective selves on the back and actually patting the other 10 of them on the back even more than me, I think we do a great job as a small Midwestern VC helping out our companies wade through the muck of venture capital and like or running a startup, more importantly even. And it's a tough thing. As you said, it is a full contact sport. And I would similarly give Rishi and Shraddha a kudos for getting in the ring and getting dirty. But there's a big difference between that and just pure fraud or lying to people.
Right.
And I personally have seen, and this is outside, I'm now taking off my cultivation capital hat, but I have seen or personally been a participant in, never was accused of anything and never knew of any wrongdoing. I want to be very clear about that up front, but I very closely saw three specific frauds so far in my career that I knew after the fact were frauds in all cases. And all of those are really just disheartening to me. And being an outside participant that has nothing to do with this one, just viewing it, you know, there's a big difference between, hey, we wanted to sell 300 screens and we could only get 200 deployed. I would say that's a bad business outcome or lack of achieving a goal.
Yeah.
And then lying and saying you had 400 screens deployed or whatever the numbers were.
Right.
Again, just going off your numbers using
wholly
any
made
specifics.
Up. Right.
Right, right, right. Like those are very, very different.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was at a holiday party of a portfolio company last night, not of cultivation, but of mine personally. And I ran into somebody and they really drew a big distinction in another deal totally, but that we had known about the same company. They drew a big distinction between, you know, personal character. Mm-hmm. Of individuals and business outcomes. And in that case, they saw a really phenomenal business outcome in some circumstance and saw a personal flaw in the founder. This is someone I am actually working with on a project. They saw a personal flaw in a founder that has made them say, you know, we will never work with this person again, even though we love the business they represent.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very, very minor thing. So I guess my cautionary tale to all of the founders out there listening to this is you have to be really, really careful. And I think a lot of founders are reticent to show their investors the bad or negative side of things. As an investor, I think we all know there's another layer to the onion. There's a bad side of almost every person or company out there. It's how you represent that will determine whether we now speaking for all investors of all kinds out there, work with you or not. And I have seen our immediate team at Cultivation not do a deal because of founders' actions. Not because of business outcomes, but because of how a founder responded to us about business outcomes that were for the most part out of their control. And for the most part, we agreed with their actions, but they then tried to hide them from us. And as your partner, that's not okay.
Right.
And so, I mean, and I think that's actually very then analogous to what's going on in this case is, you know, Google's venture arm that's invested in this, Pritzker Ventures and others are saying, hey, wait a minute. This may or may not have gone right, but you lied to me. And in fact, by the way, in this case specifically, you went way out of your way to lie to me.
Right.
If all of the stories that exist about faking screenshots of their auditing system and lying to internal external third-party auditors, if all of that's true, they did go way out of their way to deceive a whole bunch of people when they could have said, you know, guys, it's not going as well as we thought.
Yeah.
Here's the differences.
Yeah.
So I think that's an important distinction to draw is bad business outcomes are something that I think a lot of companies are afraid to show their investors. And I would actually say as an investor, you should show your investors that first and say, hey, look, this might not have gone perfectly. Here was our plan. Here was what happened. There's a difference between those two. I want your help differentiating this and figuring out how to get back on the right path. If you instead sweep that under the rug, that is the shortest path to either not getting a check or certainly not getting a follow-on support and funding from your investors.
Right. So it's really important to remember, and this is pretty basic stuff. So you know, this is going to seem like review for everybody, but it bears mentioning again, like, startups, like trying to figure out how to phrase this, you know, so startups are depending on the definition of startup that you want to use, you know, they are sort of almost by all definitions, you know, really high risk venture, you know, high risk sort of endeavors to take advantage of a emerging business opportunity with the potential for relatively high growth. And by proxy, you know, an outsized financial outcome in a relatively short period of time. And with that level of risk, in order to sort of like achieve the level of performance or to take full advantage of a business opportunity, like there are going to be people should be experimenting and like. Like the definition of an experiment is that you're trying stuff out and you have, and like, there should be that safe space to fail. And failure sucks for everybody. Right. But like, you can learn from failure as long as everybody's being honest about it. Right. It could have been a matter of saying, you know what, we really were over our skis when we said that we were going to deploy, you know, X amount of screens, or achieve a certain amount of ad impressions. But like, you know, for various operational reasons, we weren't able to achieve that. Right. If people came forward, and said, you know, some flavor of that and, you know, come hat in hand and say, oh, you know, this sucks. Like, we'll try to do better. We'll try to revise our forecast going forward, whatever, like, if people were just upfront with that type of failure or were upfront about, you know, shortcomings in their business operations or financial performance or whatever, we would not be talking about, you know, a $1 billion fraud with the potential for felony charges. Well, sorry, felony charges already filed with the potential of felony convictions. You know, we wouldn't be talking about that today. And it's really unfortunate from my perspective to see folks who seemed so desperate to grow a business as quickly as possible that they would, you know, really relinquish the only moral high ground that an entrepreneur can have, which is first and foremost being, you know, transparent and forthright with the folks who are backing their business. And that's not just, you know, investors, you know, the financial enablers of business, but it's also like with employees and with, you know, probably to a much lesser extent, you know, their customers or clients or whatever. But like at bare minimum, you know, if you're a founder of a company, you should be on, you know, you should have pretty, even if it's a difficult, you know, conversation, you know, everybody, all the major stakeholders in a business, perhaps especially, you know, your financial backers, should have some degree of transparency into the actual state of your business. You know, and sorry, yeah, I'm gonna just say one last thing. If this is all true, you know, then throw the effing book at them.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. A Crain's Chicago business article that will certainly be included in our show notes. Also quotes Eric Gordon, who's a professor of entrepreneurship. Yep, at University of Michigan, and also Howard Tolman. Howard is a well-respected community of the member of the community of Chicago Venture, formerly CEO of 1871, as well as running a venture fund and some other ways that he's participated in the community. And I think all of those are great quotes that are included. Rishi was on the board of the CEC, which I believe is the organization that runs 1871. So, I mean, you know, there were unfortunately very deep ties between this company and the Chicago ecosystem.
I mean, it goes deeper than that. You know, like Shaw was named a, you know, a special advisor to a number of different, you know, to a number of different venture firms, right? Besides, I mean, 1871 / CEC, its parent organization, is not a venture fund per se. It's a technology hub that receives some government backing from both like the state and the county and the city, as well as from sort of private donors and all the rest to like serve as the entrepreneurial center for the city of Chicago. But like, you know, he was also named as a senior advisor to Pritzker Group Venture Capital, which is the venture capital fund that was formerly led by, you know, Illinois' current governor, J.B. Pritzker, who's also a major benefactor of the CEC and 1871 by proxy. He was Shaw was named as a advisor to Chicago Ventures and to a whole bunch of other firms. You know, they're like Rishi and Shraddha. I found this really good article also from shout out to Crain's journalist John Pletz, who is just been a dogged reporter on all manner of context media / outcome health related stuff. You know, this is an article from 2014. Rishi Shaw told John Pletz from Crain's that Rishi and Shraddha started their own little venture firm called Jumpstart Ventures. And Jumpstart Ventures had made dozens and dozens of investments in Chicago's, in the startup ecosystem of Chicago, but they also made investments in some companies based in San Francisco and New York as well. You know, their portfolio companies include a bunch of, they've invested in like 40 or 50 odd companies, but includes like Chicago based, you know, currently a billion-dollar company called SMS Assist. They invested in Built-In, Base CRM, Y Charts, Swipe Sense, like a whole bunch of these, you know, like decently successful companies, you know, all received capital from Jumpstart Ventures. But in addition to investments in startups, the firm, so Jumpstart had also made a number of investments in as a limited partner in investment funds, including, you know, a firm called Avia. An angel group that Rishi and Shraddha were big supporters of, you know, apart from their financial contributions to the group is called the Firestarter Fund. They were also, you know, major boosters of the Firestarter Fund in the media, and they also made a limited partner investment in one of Chicago Ventures' funds. That influence goes really, really, really deep in Chicago. And, you know, I on the one hand, I'm very happy to see that many of the investment firms and other organizations that Shah and Agarwal had contributed their time and financial resources to, that they've since been removed, at least from their websites, stating that they were advisors and stuff. And I'm going to make the assumption that they were actually removed as advisors as well. Like I have not heard a lot of public commentary from folks that were previously advised by Shraddha and Rishi, you know, to really denounce the, there's no other way to say it. Allegedly, criminal activity by these two entrepreneurs, and there's a lot of uncertainty about, you know, what will end up transpiring, you know, as these folks end up going through their, going to trial and seeing what's what. There's some stuff that I did also want to bring up, you know, because like the stuff about, you know, misrepresenting the number of, you know, ad impressions and that $70 million settlement that was agreed to as part of a non-prosecution agreement regarding those particular issues. The thing that we just got done talking about, that was a press release published in late October of this year. There was another release from November 25th and here's the headline, also from the Department of Justice. Former executives and employees of health technology company Outcome Health charged in $1 billion fraud scheme. So what's important to note here, sorry, Graham, I know you're chomping at the bit, but this is the second, you know, set of charges is a consequence of the first, because, you know, not only was the company defrauding its customers, right? The pharmaceutical companies and the medical device companies, you know, who paid for ad impressions, but the resulting resulting misstatements of revenue and of other sort of financial and other business performance metrics resulted in the company in turn relaying those, you know, fraudulent numbers to their investors, to investment banks, to, you know, other firms that they were trying to solicit, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in additional, you know, financial support from, you know, that there wasn't just this business fraud, but this has resulted now in $1 billion, you know, alleged financial fraud as well. Which for the record, Rishi and Shraddha have pled not, you know, they've pled not guilty to, and this will, you know, probably end up going to trial and such, but you know, it's like one thing cascades out of the other, and I don't know how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Yeah,
it's really a not great situation.
Well, you covered a lot of ground there.
I did. I'm so sorry for monologuing at you for like 5 minutes was. But,
you know, I mean, I think, you know, there's a bunch of different thoughts that I have on different components of that. You know, I mean, you know, one is certainly from a fund perspective. Obviously, funds should be careful about, you know, who they're engaging as their external advisors. And I know a lot of funds, including ours, do that as a regular practice. You know, and I think one of the other things that's also interesting to note is, you know, we're talking a lot about Rishi and Shraddha. If you actually read the DOJ, you know, filing, or at least the brief about the filing, there are actually, I think, six people from Outcome, four executives and two employees who are actually called out for different things. And I think the six of them are each individually called out for different things and then kind of collectively, you know, called out broadly for the fraud here. So, you know, I think it's, you know, overall, this is this is a cautionary tale to anybody who invests in and works at as an executive or works even for executives at a startup. But overall, I think that's a great thing because I think people, I mean, there certainly needs to be an increased call for corporate responsibility out there. You know, one of the things that I found interesting in the Cranes article was talking about that, like, hey, you can hype up your business. You know, one of the things that's actually one of my favorite phrases is like, fake it till you make it.
Sure.
But you got to be careful, I guess, saying that now because like, there's, you know, the direct quote from Eric Gordon, professor of entrepreneurship at University of Michigan is, hype is one thing and the market can discount for it, but fraud is something else and it subverts the market. And specifically the SEC lawsuit says, you know, hey, Outcomes business was not vaporware, you know, because something as an entrepreneur that you look out for a lot is like, is there, you know, cause some element of this, or there's this term out there, vaporware, like, is there some elements of this where people are just dramatically over-promising and under-delivering? And specifically, at least again, I'm getting this from the Crane's Chicago Business article, but it's referencing the SEC lawsuit, specifically says, hey, this wasn't vaporware. People were sold real advertising on real screens in real doctor's offices. And by the way, the business is still operating. In fact, I actually work in a WeWork, our other favorite whipping boy.
Sure.
But out of the same office building as Outcome Health is located on. I think it's actually two floors above its office is two floors above my office. But you know, again, the SEC lawsuit alleges that the results that its advertisers were receiving were around 23% inflated. So said another way, about one quarter inflated. So three quarters of the business is real. And so again, getting back to some of those earlier points, it'd be easier to just say, you know, hey, we were shooting for 100, we hit 77. And isn't that good enough? Or not isn't that good enough? We should be striving harder if we said our plan was to hit 100, but shooting for the moon and landing two-thirds of the way there or three-quarters of the way there
not
is
terrible.
Still pretty good as
yeah.
a lot of startups go. And, you know, I mean, we see startups who exceed their projections and we always love that. Although then we usually have questions about how they projected and we would want them to project higher next time. Because generally cultivation and even speaking for myself, the way I've run the companies I've run in the past and the way that I've seen things operate, it's better to be aspirational. So I'm a big believer in stretch goals. So if someone simply reports, hey, we were shooting for 100, we hit 77, generally there's going to be a lot of questions we would ask about why there was that delta. And then we would say, attaboy, let's get after it and let's hit 100 next year. And so I guess I'm sure there was no one day where any of the six people named in this lawsuit and potentially more people who will come in lawsuits to follow said, hey, we were telling the truth yesterday and we're going to start committing fraud today. And again, I've been, although never a participant, only an unwitting participant in some of these, but I've been a lot closer to some frauds as well, never anything nearly as large as this. In all of those cases, I think it's like kind of a death by a thousand cuts where it's a, hey, today we make a decision that's slightly less than ethical and tomorrow we make one that's slightly bigger than today's less than ethical decision. Not defending that. I hope and assume that it wasn't like one day we're telling the truth and one day we're lying by a quarter of our results. I bet there was some story or explanation of how you start overstating your business outcomes by nearly a third. And again, I get being aspirational and I get saying, hey, let's absolutely strive for something higher. Let's slightly overpromise and find a way to go deliver. That's the way startups should work. And I'd encourage any startup out there to work that way. But then you have to report certainly to your investors and certainly to your customers and probably to your employees. You should report what are the actual truths. And so that's the thing that I would want to dig into a lot more. I mean, probably if I worked for the SEC, but definitely if I was almost a business coach or psychologist in this case, I'd want to say, okay, so, you know, if you had just gone to these investors and said, you know, we're shooting for this and it's not quite that good yet, and here's our plan to get there, I guess my question is, how much worse would they have reacted or responded to that? And again, the SEC lawsuit is specifically where I'm quoting that it brings up that 23% overstatement in success. And, you know, I mean, again, it specifically says this isn't fake technology. They're not doing what they say they are. They just say they're doing all right. They're just claim they're doing about a third more, 23% out of 100%. So about a third of the claimed results are just not real.
Yeah.
And so I would have a lot of questions about how that actually came to be. And there's got to be a really clear line that I'm sure any of the six people named in this lawsuit, or many people who probably still work at Outcome, which again is still an operating company, probably would say, you know, there's a murky gray area. And one day I walked into that, and the other day I walked out on the side that was black, and I knew that I had crossed this chasm, but where the beginning and end of that is exactly, I don't know. And so I would want to explore that a whole lot more. But again, that's for my own, I guess, psychological enjoyment, not for any other maybe business purpose.
Well, to boil your statements down a little bit, right? Like, entrepreneurial ambition is not a crime. Lying about, you know, your progress to date, depending on the scope and scale of the lie, is a crime, potentially. And that, you know, it's, on the one hand, like, I've met Rishi and Shraddha. When I was a younger lad, you know, I had a little startup and my startup participated in a startup weekend, Rishi was a judge at. You know, I have, people that I know, you know, received, backing and mentorship from, you know, Rishi and Shraddha. A mentor of mine, you know, had mentioned to me, you know, I had coffee with them some time ago, and I'd mentioned some stuff. Because again, you guys got to remember, at least for the time being, you know, I'm currently a reporter and was a reporter back then. You know, I was meeting with this mentor of mine, and you know, the topic sort of came to, you know, stuff that I was hearing through, you know, the grapevine of, you know, about Outcome Health. And, you know, he had articulated to me, my mentor had articulated to me, his disbelief and disappointment in what I was saying. Not disappointment in me, but disappointment in the company and its founders, because, you know, he'd said that at least Shraddha was a major, an inspirational figure to his own daughter. And I can't imagine the confidence, you know, that was shaken by all this stuff finally coming to light. And to echo your earlier point, it is really sad. And I am not, for the record, I am not dancing on the grave of Outcome Health. I am mourning at it, because, you know, because this is such a reputational black eye on Chicago and on Midwestern startups in general. And the reason I say that is because, and this is where we get, you know, a spicy Jason take, like, it's that like, And I feel like I can say this because I'm talking to you from the comfort of a chilly downstairs apartment in Oakland, California. It's that Chicago's startup ecosystem and its culture, at least from my perspective as a participant within it, as an entrepreneur and as an observer of it, as a reporter and as a contributor to it, as a volunteer, as a person who participates in various startup and entrepreneurship events and initiatives, like it seems like there's this tremendous drive, which is very admirable for the record, to grow a startup ecosystem that is, if not as prolific in its success as Silicon Valley or New York, which would be challenging to do sort of overnight because of various sort of like economic, structural, and community structure stuff that, the startup communities can benefit from like decades and decades of ongoing success. But it seems like there's been a serious drive to make up for a lot of, you know, I'm not going to call it lost ground, but you know, Chicago as a startup hub, it can be argued had a slightly later start than its coastal counterparts. But that doesn't necessarily mean that companies based in Chicago all of a sudden have license to quote unquote grow using any means necessary, including, you know, malfeasance and subterfuge and fraud, to make up for that lost ground. And to that earlier point about, you know, entrepreneurial ambition not being a crime, like it isn't, but it seems as though the folks that we're talking about here tried to grow too big too fast, you know, and they are sort of the that's the Icarus and Daedalus story of you know, flying too close to the sun with wings made of wax. And we are now seeing the consequences of that meltdown. So, yeah, it's a mess.
And I completely echo those comments. I mean, I think that, you know, again, I think the Midwest ecosystem has long been reaching for and long searching for the right types of big success stories like the coastal ecosystems you talked about, and probably like some other international ecosystems that have seen some big success. You know, Groupon might have been that success at one point in time. I don't think it is today. Last I checked, $2.5 or $3 billion market cap in its publicly traded, endeavors, down half from, you know, what Google offered to buy it for. I would love to see, as a big believer in the Midwest, I think there are smart, innovative people here.
100%.
And to any startup out there, I guess I would say you should use any legal means necessary and then be honest about where you've been successful and where you haven't, to grow. Because I guess the other thing, like just looking at this, I don't know if this is psychological or what, but, you know, kind of going to some sort of deeper level, you also, if you fail, or if you achieve 77% of your targeted goal as a startup, you've actually probably been a huge success.
Yes.
And if you're honest about reporting that to your investors, customers, and other stakeholders, employees, and other, it's very likely you'll have a lot of respect. And there will be a lot of people out there who say, great job, and let's figure out how that number can be 100 or 120% next year, and want to take you under their wing and want to work with you closely and want to invest in you. So I don't know where, around 75 or 80% goal achievement became something where you needed to lie about the rest. By the way, I'm saying this as goal achievement. It may not have been that their goals were 100% of what they reported. The SEC lawsuit claims that 23% is the overstatement kind of amount in this case.
Right.
But regardless of that, if you're a startup, if you're out there changing the way the world thinks about drugs or whatever else, I mean, I want to talk to you. I want to give you a kudos, and I want to see if there's a way I and my team can help you move to the next level. And we have startups all the time who we give a huge congratulations to who fall down towards their goal achievement. We all know that there's some overstatement in what a startup says they're going to achieve in 1 to 5 years.
The financial models are made up or everything has an up and to the right hockey stick graph attached to it. But
I actually love it in a pitch when people are pitching me. I actually appreciate if people realize that and say, okay, and here's our hockey stick. You can dig into it later. But, that's kind of not what we're here for.
Right.
Because I'm going to be disappointed if we don't see that there's a big market to go after. But at the same time, I'm also going to be, not expecting that those are real numbers that are going to be hit. And once we dig into the business, we're excited, and we're going to be there to help you. Even if you only achieve 3/4 of the results you were targeting, if you achieve 3/4 of the results you're targeting, you're probably going to be nearly best in class for most venture invested companies, by the way. I don't know if a lot of venture investors would say that, but if you compare, if you look historically at what was promised by companies, and what is then achieved at them after the fact, I bet if you are at 77% achievement, I bet you are near, and by that I specifically mean financial revenue generating results, I bet you are near best in class. Some exceed, most fall short, and we all kind of discount for that. As this University of Michigan professor acknowledges, and as a venture investor acknowledge, we're all expecting people will miss. It's a question of how you respond to that. It's not that you miss or by how much even. It's how you and your team are going to respond to that and how you're going to grow and make the next year's target.
Yeah. So
in my opinion,
we are going a little bit long, but to extend what has already been a very long episode, I just have two concluding points. Which is that, first of all, we're talking about privately held companies here. If you're a founder, your executive team and your employees are beholden to a very small handful of private investors, typically. You are the whole reason why companies choose to stay private is they're not subject to the sometimes very short-term attitude of public markets, right? If you're a publicly traded company and you come in and say, we missed our revenue target by 20% or 25%, your stock price is going to tank, a lot. There's a range, but it's not going to do well. In startups, your company is only priced, when you go and raise a new round of funding. That's when a price is locked in. You can drive prices, through, valuation mechanisms otherwise. But really, if you're on a 2-year, cadence of fundraising, a year and a half cadence of fundraising, a 3-year cadence of fundraising, it doesn't really matter. If you screw up 1/4, if you miss your goal 1/4, or you got a little overexcited and said that you wanted to achieve goals that, operationally you just didn't have the capacity to make, that's okay, because it's privately held companies. Because these are privately held companies. You don't have Main Street, retail investor capital on the line. Not directly, at least, right? You're still, if you have venture capital backing, you might have, like, by proxy, a pension fund, you know, invests in VCs, and you don't want to, like, just go have a bunch of worker, you know, workers' retirement funds or charitable endowment money or whatever go up in smoke because of, you know, your either poor planning or overly ambitious goal setting. But, like, there shouldn't be that type of incentive to lie and commit financial fraud just in the name of meeting your numbers in privately held companies. And I really hope that there's more honesty around that stuff going forward. And that just brings me to at least my own final point, which is that, to your earlier point, Graham, you know, entrepreneurs, executive teams, you know, employees, that they should strive to grow a business in whatever way is legal. But I think that legal standard is necessary but insufficient. And what I think needs to, what I hope to see a lot more of, and I say this as somebody who's sort of nominally a journalist, reportery type person, like, I want to see a much higher ethical standard on the business side too, right? It's not just enough to say, well, we're compliant with regulations. It's that we're also, you know, honest and forthcoming with our investors and employees, even when things might not necessarily be the most ideal of circumstances at the moment, or we may have missed our goals, or, you know, there's a potential takeover thing or whatever. Like, all this stuff, I want to see, like, I want, if there's an entrepreneur listening, if there's an investor listening, I want the case of, you know, Rishi Shah and Shraddha Agarwal and a number of other employees and executives who were enablers of severe misrepresentation on the order of $1 billion, you know, to take that as a case example and to say that you know, meeting your numbers and appeasing your, you know, the people that you answer to, whether it's your investors, whether it's your, you know, your executives, whether it's whatever, that it's just not worth, you know, sacrificing that ethical and moral high ground of at least being honest and forthright about where things are going and how you're doing as a business.
I think that's a great point to end on. Okay. And I would say that, you know, I think started the topic, at least for me, saying, you know, kind of shame on them. And, you know, overall, I think that that's a really great point. I think it's great to say, hey, you know, like, I think any startup who would have come out and said, hey, these are our real results, and this is what we hoped for, and this is what we promised. And I think any startup who would publicly or near publicly say that, as you point out, public market company that many of them aspire to be or be acquired into, are required by the SEC and in fact audited to that standard. You know, I mean, I would love to see more, at least of the larger companies who aren't going to give away any trade secrets or anything, strive to be exactly that way.
Yeah.
And saying, hey, I was shooting for something big. I wanted to change the world. And for the most part, Jason, I agree with you that I don't love this business, but my comments about negativity about them are really, as a Midwestern investor and someone who believes that the Midwest could do great things for the technology and startup ecosystems worldwide. So I would love to see them have said, hey, we were shooting for something big and changing the way medicines are advertised, and we fell down on that. And instead, they obviously, or they allegedly, went the other way. And so, you know, it's, I guess it's too bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would echo your call to any startup entrepreneur or investor out there and say, you know, please go far and away above what maybe I said a minute ago, but go far and away above growth at any cost. Think growth at any cost. And then from there, be as fully transparent as you are comfortable with, certainly with your investors, customers, and employees, your direct stakeholders. And I think actually most people, even who have the guttural reaction of being non-transparent to the market, most people see more benefit once they become transparent, even to the open public market, than they see negativity, even at an early stage. Again, not saying put your code base out there if that's not right in your business model. We talked about open source software before in a prior episode. I'm not saying, you know, release all of your financial results. Those are obviously private to, you know, to a company, but, you know, be ethical, be transparent to the extent you can, and share what makes sense.
Yep.
And I think a lot more companies will benefit more than they will see detriment if they follow that general code.
I'm right there with you, man. All right. Well, Graham, we've gone a little bit long. I think this might be this might be our longest episode yet. Clocking in at almost
real close.
An hour and, well, if I stop call recorder in 12:10, it'll be exactly an hour and 15 minutes. Graham, well, say something. I got 5 seconds of air to
fill. Anyone who's still listening, thank you for hanging in there with us.
All right.
We'll talk soon.